Hello, everyone, and welcome back to our podcast on American constitutional law. We are going to take a bit of a pivot and transition this week from thinking about the different branches of government and their respective powers to looking at more of the different topic areas that tie into government power. And the first one we're going to tackle is related to government power in response to things like foreign affairs, terrorism, or even wartime. As has been our practice in the past, I would ask that you go ahead and open up the slides for this week. This should be the week 9 slides on foreign affairs, terrorism, and war. And with those slides, what we're going to do is follow our normal process. We're going to walk through the topics. We're going to get an introduction with these slides to different powers that qualify under these larger headings of defense and foreign affairs. Then we're going to talk about the timeline and the progression that has occurred in terms of the court's examination of these powers, because it's not simply straightforward or expansive. It hedges back and forth depending on the context and the time. And then we will, as per usual, do our review of different cases that touch on foreign affairs, terrorism, and war. In these slides, I'm going to introduce a lot of cases that we're not going to get into in depth. It's going to be some very high 30,000 foot view kinds of summaries of a range of different cases because there's so much that qualifies as falling under foreign affairs. So to give us a sense of the different flavors that come under that label, I have talked about quite a few cases in the slides. And again, we'll walk through the brief summaries of those with a bit more time spent on the kinds of cases that we would normally think about for our layman's terms assignments. All right, without any further ado, let's just jump right into this. So when it comes to the topic of foreign affairs, the thing that makes it so complicated with constitutional law is that so little of what qualifies as foreign affairs is really written into the Constitution. Now, we do have quite a few enumerated foreign affairs and defense powers, and these are listed on slide 3. This would include things like the president being able to accept envoys or foreign representatives, commerce and trade being governed by Congress, the ability to put down invasions and rebellions, or provide for the common defense. That's actually the language there under the section which designates legislative powers. And then, of course, we have declarations and the waging of war. Again, the power to declare war is solely that of the Congress, but in practice, we've kind of gotten away from that whole official action of declaring a war. Now, again, this is what's actually listed and enumerated, which means there is a whole lot on the table that isn't described or explained in any real depth. And this is not to surprise us, right? I mean, we're now several weeks into this course. We've reviewed the Constitution a fair bit. It's not the most lengthy document, so this isn't going to be a novel telling us exactly which entities and how we should engage with foreign affairs. And we're also talking about a document that is drafted at a time when you're pretty much inventing a new country, so maybe we're not so sure exactly how this should work. And we're also coming from the context, historically speaking, of the states themselves having a lot of foreign affairs powers. Those states were almost their own independent governments under the Articles of Confederation, so they may have negotiated with other countries kind of as their own independent entity. So the Constitution as we have it doesn't have that much detail or that much text related to foreign affairs, which means that this term can cover a wide range of topics. It can be everything from cooperation and collaboration up to and including war, as long as there's some form of international engagement, right? Something outside of our borders. That is what we would typically label as foreign affairs. But again, we're still dealing with a lot of vagueness here. So let's think about what's missing in particular with respect to the idea of foreign affairs. And this is going to jump us up to slide 5. So if we adopt a constitutional law approach to foreign affairs, and we don't have clearly outlined details about the powers of foreign affairs, then we have to kind of invent where these missing powers come from, because the Constitution is not explicit about it, doesn't lay it out in detail. So these are what I call the two extra approaches. We can either find foreign affairs powers through extrapolation or through an extra constitutional method. Okay, so the definitions of each of these approaches is on slide 5. Extrapolation, under that it says, particular powers assigned to the various branches or denied to the states necessarily imply the missing powers required for the conduct of foreign affairs. Okay, so what this is saying is, because there's certain powers given to things like the Congress or the presidency, and they're not allowed to the states, that means that the other things that are missing in the background naturally would belong to the federal government, because that's what they meant or intended in the background. The extent and distribution of powers over foreign affairs can be derived from the express grants of power in the Constitution. So we are extrapolating here by saying there are certain explicit things in the Constitution, and we're going to say, based on that existing language, there are other things that obviously exist with foreign affairs that aren't described here, and we can understand that because we already have some things in writing, the other things that are not in writing should tie in to the national government. That's where it belongs, because yes, Congress can declare war, and yes, the president can receive foreign representatives. So clearly, any other missing foreign affairs powers would go with the national government. Now, this stands in contrast to what's called the extra constitutional approach. And this is a bit of a stretch, I'm not gonna lie. I really find this section of our textbook interesting, because what it says is, guess what? Those missing powers, well, you're not gonna find them in the Constitution, and you're not even gonna try and extrapolate from that. We're simply going to go with the same kind of layout that we had when we were the federal government under the British Crown. And you know what? At that time, it was all about the federal government, right? The powers pertaining to foreign affairs, external powers, had already been lodged in the federal government as an inheritance from the British Crown at the time that the United States became a sovereign nation, and thus they did not rest on a delegation from the people or the states. So, in essence, this is the way it was before, so why would we assume it has changed? And we're definitely not relying on any part of the Constitution to help us understand or evaluate these foreign affairs powers. That's the way it was. So yeah, we're gonna keep going with this, even though, again, we're not relying on the text in any way, shape, or form. Which, for constitutional law, introduces a few necessary and rather important questions. But if we consider these two approaches, okay, so the Supreme Court's gonna have to come at it from either, well, we base it on the text that's in the Constitution, and we see these other things, so naturally we would assume that the unlisted powers of foreign affairs go with the federal or national government, or we would simply go back to looking at maybe a more originalist approach and say, okay, well, clearly this was the structure that existed under the Articles of Confederation, or even under the monarchy back when the United States was the colonies. And because they don't lay anything out about that, we're going to go ahead and use the text, the history, and the tradition that existed without so much in the way of text, right? We're focusing more on the history and tradition, which is very recently one of the more prominent phrases you will hear coming out of the Supreme Court, particularly with originalist decisions. There is the language of text, history, and tradition that comes up frequently in relation to different topics. It has been introduced in relation to several Second Amendment or gun rights cases. It has come up in relation to the Dobbs v. Jackson abortion decision. And in fact, it predates all of those decisions. You can see this evolution with the Supreme Court's decision-making, such that we do have history and tradition kind of setting up the long frame of reference, or the long-term kind of look for originalism going all the way back to the 1980s. But okay, I have diverted too far from the slides. Let's bring it back, Jenny. And let's get into the details on those different foreign affairs cases. So slide 7 starts us out with something dating back to 1984, Reagan v. Wald. Does the president have the right to place travel restrictions prohibiting citizens from going to certain countries? Well, in this quick case, we said yes. And I want you to read the language there about given the traditional deference to executive judgment in the realm of foreign policy, there is an adequate basis under the Due Process Clause to sustain the president's decision to curtail by restricting travel the flow of hard currency to Cuba. Okay, so we're talking about the embargo on travel to Cuba, right? We're at a point in time in the 1980s where that is not one of our allies in the United States. And so we are limiting the flow of people, goods, currency to Cuba. And the Supreme Court saying, well, we have the Due Process Clause. We have the ability using that to sustain this presidential power. So we're going to let that stand. And you'll note here, deference again. Harkening back to the last time we had material in this class about administrative law, we talked about things like Chevron deference and our deference, which is deference that the court gives to different executive agencies. Well, it also has deference just in general for the executive branch. So that's what they're referencing here in this 1984 case. Now, we're going to skip ahead quite a bit in time, and let's jump to the next case in 2012, Arizona v. United States. Okay, so in 2012, I was actually living in Arizona when this happened, Arizona passes a law called SB 1070. And under this law, what is expected is that, let's say law enforcement has a traffic stop. Well, during that traffic stop, you are supposed to, if you suspect that someone is here illegally, require some form of documentation to check their immigration status. Are they here legally or are they not? And the state made it a misdemeanor for you to be in Arizona if you were an illegal alien. Now, this brings up a foreign affairs issue because what we're talking about is aliens, and aliens have largely been governed by federal law. So the question that comes up with Arizona v. United States is, can states create specific laws pertaining to aliens of foreign countries? And the Supreme Court kind of walks a fine line on this with foreign affairs, because what they say is that Arizona could get into the realm of immigration as long as the state laws don't conflict with federal laws. But SB 1070 itself was in conflict with federal laws, so this law can't stand, but it opens up the door to say, well, maybe there's a shared space here between state government and federal government. It's just going to be a question of, is this really an area that we see conflict between the two levels of government? And we're going to transition this conversation nicely into what comes up next week, which is federalism. The balance between what powers does the national government have or the federal government have, and what powers do state governments have? Slide 9 just includes a quick snip of an image that was actually taken in Tucson, where after SB 1070 saw these massive protests about the law, because for most people, what it amounted to was profiling. And if someone looks like they're an immigrant, now we're going to ask for their papers. So we definitely had questions of, is this only targeted towards brown people? And why is that a crime? Now, again, the Supreme Court overrules SB 1070 by saying that no, Arizona, this law conflicts with federal law. And when that happens, we have this whole structure where the federal law trumps the state laws, right? But I like to include this image just because, yep, this is actually something I got to see firsthand. And it's a very interesting case because what it did wasn't shut down the conversation around whose authority is involved in cases of things like, or topics like immigration. It left that door a little bit open. And I think that sets us up for today where we have a lot of conflict between states like Texas and the federal government. The final case I have listed as a prominent foreign affairs case is Zivotofsky v. Kerry from 2015. And this is an interesting case, not so much because of the case facts or the details of the case, but because of what was going on in the background. So the legal question you'll see listed there is, can the Secretary of State recognize Israel as the country of birth for someone born in Jerusalem? Now, the background story of this all is that Congress and the President are competing here on some level with respect to foreign affairs powers. So we have an inter-branch dynamic where we have conflict over who gets to say. And of course, this brings into this case the question of what country is overseeing Jerusalem? Who does it belong to? Which is, of course, a very contentious topic in and of itself as well. So the issue is a child is born in Jerusalem, and what someone once listed on the passport is Israel, right? The country of birth is Israel for someone born in Jerusalem. And the Congress had passed into law that this is something that the Secretary of State could do. But what the Supreme Court says and upon evaluation is, nope, this is simply for the president and the president alone. Congress doesn't get the power to recognize other countries. That is something that belongs to the executive branch and to the president themselves due to what's known as the reception clause, which says that presidents will receive foreign ambassadors, that whole foreign envoy thing that we started out with earlier in these slides. And you'll note in here that the language that I've used is other states. In the language of political science and international relations, you call other countries states, much like we would call Alabama or Nebraska a state. That is just the language that we use in, again, international relations. So that may be a little bit weird looking, but that's what it means. When it says states and it's talking about foreign affairs, generally it means other countries. So to this point, we've talked about travel restrictions, we've covered laws on immigration, and we've even thought about the recognition of other countries. But much of what is going to be at, let's say, the source of the legal question when it comes to the Supreme Court is stuff that has to do with conflict and even wartime. Because this is when we tend to butt heads a lot when it comes to foreign affairs. So before we get into that, I want to do a quick review because a lot of us assume, and I think it's natural to do this, by the way, a lot of us assume that war is something that regularly happens in the United States and that we do recognize it as such. In fact, we've described numerous conflicts we've been involved in as war. But when we have actually been at war is when Congress makes that declaration. So constitutionally speaking, we've only declared war a very few times in U.S. history. Slide 12 lists all of the times we've had a formal declaration of war and who we've declared war against. So between 1812 and 1942, there's a total listing of 8 declarations of war. So you might wonder, does that mean we haven't gone to war at other times? And formally speaking, the answer would be yes. But of course, we know that the United States has been involved in different wars, even if it hasn't been declared formally as such. Now, slide 13 is a little bit more of a historical lens on what's happened since 1942. And when I highlight these events or these situations, what I'm talking about are more like the major conflict or major war events that have occurred post-World War II. So that includes the Korean War, that includes the Vietnam War, the Persian Gulf War, the longest war that we've been involved in, the war in Afghanistan, and the Iraq War. And then we have other minor conflicts, which aren't even listed here, that would never have been called war, but definitely have involved the armed forces of the United States engaging in conflict with different groups. We can include any number of smaller skirmishes or smaller involvements. You know, Afghanistan's war is listed as 2001 to 2021, but we had extensive involvement with the proxy war there that happened in the 1980s. So it's clear that we've been at war more than when we've formally declared it. But again, we're going to focus on more of the constitutional factors. So let's talk about what the case law is on defense and war. And by case law, I just want to clarify again, we're talking about what decisions have been made by the Supreme Court with respect to this topic. So the first case, which is actually an interesting investigation following on that little discussion I just had, was Bass v. Tingey in 1800, where they called a maritime skirmish an imperfect war because there was a declaration of hostilities. So it's still a war and therefore may have to follow things like the rules or laws of war. And then jump us up to 1863. This is right in the context of the Civil War era, right? We have the prize cases, and this is an interesting dynamic where essentially the question of whether a war exists is to be decided by the president. So it's not necessarily about the formal declaration of war, but whether the status of a war exists. And you might not have called the Civil War a war formally, but it might have been called a rebellion, it might have been called an uprising, but instead it is labeled as a war, and the Supreme Court again defers to the executive, to the presidency, on that labeling. Now, follow on to that case, Ex parte Milligan, which is another case related to the Civil War. This is the case in which the president, one of our most famous presidents, Abraham Lincoln, actually tries to put into place a number of changes with respect to rights in the context of war. The biggest is that Lincoln suspends habeas corpus, which is something we'll talk about a little bit further in this episode. But there's first the suspension of habeas corpus, and then Ex parte Milligan says, no, you cannot try civilians in military tribunals. If there's still courts where civilians can be processed, we're not going to be allowing for a military tribunal approach, even if we're talking about someone in the context of war, because we don't choose that route. We have civilian courts, and as long as the civilian courts are operational, we don't need to resort to military tribunals because military tribunals adopt quite different procedures. There's still a lot of protections available through those, but civilian courts versus military tribunals, it's two different kind of court structures and paths. And that is also something else we will talk about here in just a little bit as we transition into the conversation about habeas corpus and all of the cases related to the post-9/11 era. From that point, we leap ahead to World War II with Ex parte Curran in 1942. And here's where we see a different track related to civilian courts versus military courts. Individuals who are enemy combatants, and that's a very formal technical term to be called an enemy combatant, they could be tried using a military commission, right? So we're back to that track between civilian courts or military courts. Which one do we use? And then finally, in 1944, Korematsu versus United States is a hugely important case. This considered whether it was constitutional to relocate Japanese American citizens to internment camps. In this case, the court is going to say yes, it is okay to do this to American citizens, but there's going to be some different legal theories as to why that is the case. So let's jump into the next four slides to examine the four different visions of government power in war that come out of Korematsu. And the first of these is pretty straightforward. If you have the power to wage war, that power includes everything the federal government needs to do to win that war, to wage war successfully. So, the federal government possesses all powers necessary and proper to the successful prosecution of a war, meaning, yeah, internment camps are totally on the table. If that is what will deliver a win, then we're in a context saying, yeah, government has that power. There's no need to balance that against individual rights here because the power to wage war is all about winning that war. Now, the polar opposite of this was also one of the legal theories discussed in the Korematsu opinion, and that is, look, the founders and framers didn't say there were different rights during peace versus war. So why would we, in this case, distinguish between the two and say that, yeah, war means military necessity and doing whatever we have to do to win? Why would the framers have not included that if they felt that way? I mean, they were writing the Constitution literally in the context of the Revolutionary War. wouldn't they have at least included some component on that if that was what they had intended? So these constitutional limits, it's all applicable regardless of war or times of peace. Okay, so these two opinions are kind of the far ends of the continuum when it comes to the position on government power in war. And then we can contrast that with two alternatives that kind of fall somewhere in a different position. This next one is somewhere in between, where they say military necessity can justify the deprivation of individual rights, but judges can't just accept that the government says something's necessary and they go with that. They need to question what is actual necessity. So judges don't just defer to the military when these arguments come up. They need to examine the context and evaluate whether that really holds up, right? This would be weighing national security against individual rights. And generally speaking, we do that. We consider both sides. We can't just simply bow down to a military argument without investigating whether it's valid or not. And then the fourth and the final vision of government power in war is really altogether totally different, because what they're saying in this last one, this is not the realm for courts. War is about the preservation of a country or a government. It's not about a constitutional question, all right? So the notion of self-preservation is really what's at the heart of this all. And in order to recognize that, we really have to step back as a court and not be involved in questions such as these. So that kind of opinion would say, look, we aren't even going to investigate cases like Korematsu. We're simply going to be completely hands-off and not follow anything as far as that legal case goes. We would set it aside and we would say there's really no role for us. And this is an interesting position that comes up again when we get into the post 9/11 context, because a lot of the legislation that comes about with respect to putting suspected terrorists on trial really does try to go around or circumvent the Supreme Court and courts in general. There's a lot that comes out of Congress that has to do more with the military tribunals and the military approach, which sets it on a fundamentally different path than that which would normally be in play with civilian courts, where those would, if they had an appeal come up, be routed through the normal appeals courts and potentially up to the Supreme Court. So I've included one slide here where I ask, where do you stand on this question? For you, which of those four visions of power in war do you think is most valid? And I'm not asking in terms of constitutionality, because I think all of them have been sufficiently well argued to say that they could be constitutionally legal. But what is your personal opinion? Is war really about winning or self-preservation? Is there some need to balance between national security and war and successfully winning a war and individual rights? Because what we're talking about with Korematsu is truly an individual losing all of their fundamental freedoms to live where they want to live, participate in that in community where they want to live. I mean, Japanese internment was imposed on a huge number of individuals. Hundreds of thousands of people were actually placed into these camps, including individuals who were as young as children, right? We had children who were taken from different orphanages even and relocated into the internment camps because there was such high suspicion of collaboration with foreign governments. All right, let's pivot just one more time in thinking about powers and wartime, and let's address what happens after the Vietnam War. So we go through World War II. There is generally a strong peacetime response. We're focused on the United States, but we do have proxy war situations. And these proxy wars are the United States utilizing support and foreign forces to fight communist governments or communist entities in an effort to, you know, push back on the Soviet Union at that point in time. So a proxy war is a war that is engaged in by major powers, but they don't engage head to head in their own countries. They engage in another country and they work through the forces already fighting in that country. So in Vietnam, we have the Viet Cong and we have the forces that the United States is supporting, which is namely South Vietnam at this point in time. But we also obviously did deploy U.S. forces to Vietnam. Now, what you didn't see there were Russian forces on the front lines as well. If that had happened, what we would be having is not so much a proxy war, but a head-to-head conflict between the United States and the Soviet Union. And again, Soviet Union at the time, but we're talking about that would be present-day Russia and many of the countries surrounding Russia. But in all of this, what we had come out was generally Congress isn't committing to declaring war, and there's a lot of reliance on the executive to successfully wage that war. So in 1973, what you get is the actual pushback from Congress, because there had been so much delegation, or not even delegation formally, but just kind of allowing the president to take the lead with conflicts. But then there's the public response to Vietnam and the huge decrease in trust that follows that conflict. And what Congress does in 1973 is it pushes forward the War Powers Act, which says the president can only commit troops when war is declared by Congress or when there is statutory authorization, so there's got to be something in the law, or when there's a national emergency due to some attack on the U.S. They're trying to rein in the president's power here because they don't want to have these unnecessary deployments or conflicts that last for years and years and just cannot be successfully won. And this is in 1973, but what we're going to get is kind of one of these boomerang patterns where in 1973, following Vietnam, nobody's very, you know, enthralled with how the Vietnam War has been done. There's a lot of, well, there's frankly a lack of support for the leadership and the government at the time, especially with respect to this conflict. And we do see some support come back into play with different operations that happened in the 1990s. But the real boomerang and the real kind of cycling back to giving the executive more power comes with the authorization for use of military force in 2001. Okay. This is all post September 11th, right? And thinking from the perspective of what's going on at that time, there is just this huge push to support the president and the executive with following up and ensuring that whoever has carried out this attack on the United States is punished, killed, you know, essentially pursued to the ends of the earth to follow on from this just heinous attack, right? So the way I've written this up on slide 21, the president is authorized to use all necessary and appropriate force against those nations, organizations, or persons he determines planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11th, 2001. This is really a massive vote in favor of executive power and deploying the military as a follow-up across whatever countries are really needed to be targeted post 9/11. And then subsequent to that, we very quickly get what's called the Patriot Act. And the Patriot Act is yet another expansion of power, but this is related to intelligence gathering by the executive branch. So what is authorized is all sorts of new wiretap capabilities, new tracking capabilities, even the ability to pull what you're looking at, you know, at your local library. And it's all in an effort to identify terrorist activities and successfully shut those down, right? So this is the War Powers Act of 1973 is pushback on the executive to restrict their conflict powers. And the authorization for use of military force and the Patriot Act are the reverse, where we are granting more power to the executive to follow through on exactly what happened with 9/11 and to successfully pursue and frankly kill whoever engaged in that action. In the years that follow September 11, 2001, we see a handful of really critical and important cases that establish how you can actually manage a trial against a suspected terrorist who might have been affiliated with the 9/11 situation. The first two cases that come up are Hamdi v. Rumsfeld and Russell v. Bush, both in 2004. Now, of those cases, I have asked that you read the Hamdi v. Rumsfeld case because this is one of our potential layman's terms options, but also because it's an interesting consideration of an individual who's actually a U.S. citizen and what powers they have if they are deemed to be a part of the fighting forces against the United States, okay? So Yasser Hamdi is accused of fighting with the Taliban, but he's an American citizen and he is detained in the United States, but there's a question of, does he qualify as an enemy combatant? And he's given this label, but what does that mean for his recourse in United States courts? And that's really what the central kind of topic or question is all about in that case. I'd like you to go ahead and read through what's listed in the textbook for that case and be sure to focus in on concepts like enemy combatant, and then also what is the proper role for the judiciary in this context. And last but certainly not least, think about habeas corpus. Habeas corpus is the Latin phrase for essentially produce the body, right? And what that means is the ability to bring someone before a judge to determine if their detention is lawful. Generally, we would in the United States expect that you wouldn't just determine that detention is lawful, but you might find out what charges you're being held for. But at its core, habeas corpus is the ability to go before a judge to say, am I being held legally wherever I'm being held? And that comes under fire with a bunch of the legislation that happens post 9/11. So is habeas corpus something that an individual is entitled to? And who exactly does it apply to? Is it only for citizens? Is it for non-citizens? How is this going to work? And that's also the same kind of question at the heart of the Boumediene versus Bush case in 2008. In fact, it's really at the heart of all four cases that you see pictured on slide 24. And on slide 25, what I've provided there is the suspension clause, which is text of the Constitution. It's in Article 1, Section 9. And as it reads, it says, the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless when in cases of rebellion or invasion, the public safety may require it. Now, as I mentioned before, this actually had been invoked previously. This was invoked by President Lincoln during the Civil War. And in that case, what happened was individuals in the Confederate forces were placed into jails or prisons and were not brought to a judge. They were simply held indefinitely or until the conclusion of the war. But what is going on in the context of the 9/11 cases is we're talking about individuals being placed at locations like Guantanamo Bay, which is not a fully U.S. territorial structure, which is actually part of what comes up during these cases. What is Guantanamo Bay? Does it constitute U.S. territory? Is it something more like an embassy? Or what is the formal kind of status for what's going on here? Because there are specific limits that are tied to U.S. locations, at least in terms of rights or the way that we tend to interpret and approach rights. And of course, rights are also contingent upon what someone is deemed. Are they a citizen? Are they an enemy combatant? What do they qualify as in the context of this conflict? There's a few important pieces of legislation that come up in relation to these cases. And the first of these is pictured on slide 26. It's the detention, treatment, and trial of certain non-citizens in the war against terrorism. This is from 2001, and it tries to clarify who is actually subject to this law. And they start out with saying any individual who's not a U.S. citizen, right? So they are defining out citizens. They're saying citizens have a different level of rights. And then we go on to say what kinds of processes need to be applied to individuals who are non-citizens. And they very clearly define in Section 7 of that same law that military tribunals are what's going to happen here, right? They shall have exclusive jurisdiction with respect to offenses by the individual. And not just that, but Section 7, Part B, Subpoint 2 says that individual shall not have any remedy directly or indirectly through any court of the United States. So what happens in this law is you're going to go to a military tribunal and you're not going to have any other legal recourse. You won't be able to have any proceedings that go through civilian courts, any international courts, any courts in any other country. You will go through a military tribunal. And this comes under fire because what we're saying is we have a very definitive path that we are setting people on once we qualify them as a non-citizen under this legal order. But that can be problematic because it comes into direct conflict with a few other existing obligations that the United States has signed on to, one of those being the Geneva Conventions. Slide 27 presents the Third Geneva Convention from 1949, which clearly defines what qualifies as a prisoner of war and what those prisoners of war are entitled to in terms of rights. So I want to be very clear. When it comes to the laws of war, we are very, very technical. We have different and distinct labels like a prisoner of war or an enemy combatant, and those are tied to particular definitions which are very stringent and have to be adhered to because we are really trying to separate out who are the people who are participating actively in a conflict and those who are not, right? Are you just a civilian who is caught up in this, or are you someone who's an active combatant? So a prisoner of war would be someone who is a member of the armed forces of some party in the conflict. And by some party, I mean some group engaged in the conflict. It could be militias who are fighting. It could be volunteer forces who are fighting. It has to be somebody who is a part of the armed forces, okay? Now, what is expected of individuals that are engaged is that they have certain conditions that they are going to adhere to and fulfill, okay? We actually have expectations that certain fighting parties will adhere to specific behaviors. They'll have some sort of command structure. They will have distinctive signs so that we know who is a person who's fighting in the conflict versus someone who's just a bystander, an innocent bystander. That of carrying arms openly, that of conducting their operations in accordance with the laws and customs of war, okay? These are what we would call the prisoners of war, those who adhere to these rules. But what happens if someone doesn't adhere to these rules? Let's say we're talking about the current Gaza conflict and we're thinking about the actions of Hamas, because Hamas doesn't provide distinctive signs. It may not carry arms openly, or it may. And they certainly don't conduct their operations in accordance with the laws and customs of war. So if you capture a member of Hamas, would they be a prisoner of war? Or would they qualify as something else? The definitions are, again, probably for some people, just so much minutia, but they really are critical because they determine what the expectations are with respect to behavior and treatment for that individual. Turning to consideration of the treatment, slide 28 presents the rights of prisoners of war, where they cannot be held in cells or close confinement. They must be treated humanely, not subjected to a coercive interrogation. They must be able to maintain contact with the outside world. They're supposed to be allowed to send capture cards so that they are able to inform people where they are. These are all the expectations if we follow the rules, right? And there are times when certainly fighting forces have not followed the rules or the laws of war. But the general expectation is if you are an armed force of some country like the United States, which has agreed to these terms, you will behave in a manner that matches up with that. But again, if we're talking about the war on terrorism, Are we dealing with individuals who would qualify as prisoners of war, or have they, by their own actions, qualified themselves into some other status, such as enemy combatant? The term enemy combatant comes about after 9/11 as a way to label individuals not as prisoners of war, but as something outside that definition, so that the treatment of those individuals doesn't have to line up with the expectations for a prisoner of war. In essence, this is a term we would use to get around the Geneva Convention expectations and obligations. And it does come under examination by the Supreme Court with respect to these cases, or at least this set of cases, right? There's these four major cases, and they are examining all of these different questions that have to do with that. But not just that. Again, we're also going to be thinking about process. So slide 29 is a picture of the courtroom setup for a combatant status review tribunal. Combatant status review tribunals were developed after the 2004 cases to give individuals a chance to contest this label of enemy combatant. Would they be qualified as something that doesn't really get legal process? These tribunals were actually ruled on in the 2006 case of Hamdan v. Rumsfeld. So in essence, what you have in the 9/11 era, the post-9/11 era, that is a back and forth between the courts, the executive, and the Congress as to what is the legal process by which we can handle terrorist actions and individuals accused of carrying out such actions. And this back and forth comes back to always the topic of habeas corpus and what is an individual's rights. And we also persistently have this question of, are those rights tied to citizenship, or is there something bigger going on there? So I want you to be thinking about that as you read through the cases related to 9/11, specifically the Hamdi v. Rumsfeld and Boumediene versus Bush from 2008. I also want to contrast those cases with what we had previously as precedent. Under Johnson v. Eisentrager in 1950, what had been ruled at that point in time is that German prisoners couldn't appeal to U.S. courts because they weren't citizens and they weren't on U.S. soil when they were arrested. So we have this precedent that we see evolving and changing in the context of the post-9/11 world. So be thinking about all of those shifts in the way that we approach the questions of where can someone appeal to and what is the legal process if they are facing accusations of being something like an enemy combatant. Okay, that's a lot on conflict, war, terrorism, but we do have a few other cases that don't involve so much the conflict situation or scenario, certainly not wartime, but what about our powers with respect to individuals who are not U.S. citizens and who may be considered or deemed a significant threat. And let's start out with the public safety threat. So, a fairly gory case, I'm not gonna lie. This one is a bit of a hard read. So please, if you are the kind of person who wants to read all of the case details and bury yourself in them, but you tend to react strongly to, let's say, specific descriptions of gory evidence or actions, I would very much caution you to tread lightly when it comes to the case of Medellin v. Texas. On slide 31, I have put together some of the photos of the individuals who were involved in or affected by this case. Now, on the left-hand side of the screen are the pictures of two young women, Jennifer Ertman and Elizabeth Pena. They are the victims of the crime carried out by Jose Ernesto Medellin, who's pictured on the right-hand side. And George W. Bush is pictured in the middle there to the left of Mr. Medellin because he becomes involved in this case. And what's going on is there is a battle between Texas and Medellin for what is going to happen with his criminal process. Mr. Medellin is convicted of multiple violent offenses, including gang rape and homicide, and he is sentenced to death, But he pushes back by bringing into play the Vienna Convention. And the Vienna Convention I've pictured on slide 32 so that you can see some of the language there. And as it reads, it says under Article 36 that consular officers shall be free to communicate with nationals of the sending state and to have access to them. And at the core, what this case is about is this is an agreement that the United States makes. And yet Mr. Medellin says he's never able to have communication with the Mexican consulate because he's from Mexico. So have his rights been violated and how are we going to handle the process? And then ultimately there is a back and forth between the state of Texas and the executive, specifically the president, George W. Bush, in terms of, is the president going to push for fulfilling this treaty? And was the treaty self-enforcing? There's a lot of those questions that come up. Please, as you read through this, take some time with it. It's definitely a complicated case, and it's complicated a lot in terms of the discussions about treaties and treaty obligations and what's called a self-enforcing treaty. It's not so much complicated in terms of the criminal activity. And again, as I cautioned before, I would give anyone who digs into the actions taken by Mr. Medellin and his cohort with caution, right? We don't need to unnecessarily get into the gory elements because the legal question is really about what happens when we have conflict between a treaty expectation that has been acknowledged and accepted by the United States, but maybe without congressional action. And then what's going to happen with respect to specific state laws or state process that a state is pursuing in relation to a criminal investigation or criminal charges? Our final case that we will investigate with respect to foreign powers is from 2018, and it deals with the travel ban issued by President Trump. The case is Trump v. Hawaii. This is yet another pretty complicated case, and if you go to Oye and read through the case facts or the case details, you will quickly see what I mean. There are a lot of actions and executive orders issued in this process, but what the legal question is really about is whether the president has the authority to do what he did, to issue these travel bans. And if those travel bans were actually fundamentally a violation of what's captured in our First Amendment, which is called the Establishment Clause. The Establishment Clause ties to the issue of religion, and that specifically in that amendment, it prohibits Congress from making a law which establishes any formal religion for the United States, right? Congress cannot establish any religion. But were the actions taken by President Trump, where this travel ban is largely tied to countries that are predominantly Muslim, is that a violation of the Establishment Clause? Does the president have this authority? It's not in some ways unlike what you might have thought about or considered with respect to Japanese internment camps during World War II. Because again, we're basically looking at a category of people based on specific features that get discussed and, at least in the Japanese internment situation, actually defined into the law, but the travel ban becomes about countries and not specific religious individuals, although the conversations around it are much more focused on that factor of individuals than anything which would be called a more specific security threat. So as you, again, read through these, focus not so much on the crazy executive order back and forth, especially with this last one. The number of executive orders involved in this case was pretty astounding, to be honest. And again, there's a lot of process here, but go back to what does the Supreme Court say the executive can do with respect to engaging with foreign countries? We're all about foreign affairs, wartime powers. What can the government do and where can it draw the line? And I'm just going to end with a final note that's not really captured in the slides. And it's just to say this. It's very clear, based on our case law history, and by that I mean the decisions of the Supreme Court with respect to this topic, that your rights are quite different in periods of conflict than they would be in periods of peacetime. There is certainly the argument put forth in Korematsu that the framers didn't distinguish between wartime and peacetime with respect to rights, but the history we have shows a very different pattern. If you look back to the cases during World War I, there is a great deal of restriction on freedom of speech. If you look back to the suspicions around communism during World War II, post-World War II even, there is this strong push for national security over an individual's right to associate with different groups that might not be popular or might be thought of as subversive. We only need to look back briefly. I mean, it's been, a long time, but the McCarthy Red Scare hearings were definitely an era in which even the Supreme Court was supportive on a certain level of singling out individuals who identified as communist and then restricted their rights more than perhaps other individuals. We have the case of Korematsu, which shows Japanese internment. And then we have other cases that call into question post 9/11, what do you get classified as and how does that affect your rights? But the overall trend and the larger thread that runs through all of this is that we do treat rights differently during conflict and wartime than we do in peacetime, which also correspondingly means government has different powers in those eras. I just want us to keep that in mind because when we enter into a conflict such as the War on Terror, do we have a defined endpoint if we don't have a defined enemy, so to speak? When we are engaged in something like World War II, we declare war on other countries. But what about the War on Terror? Who are we fighting or what are we fighting? And is there ever an end to the war? And subsequently, what is the balance between government power and individual rights? And who gets the rights and who doesn't? Or how do we define it in law? And how do we define it in practice? Okay, that's it for my final thoughts on the government power with respect to foreign affairs, terrorism, and war. A few quick reminders now that we are post-midterm, and congratulations on that, by the way. It's always great to be post-midterm. We do have a few more things coming up that we need to get on the radar, and I want to throw a quick reminder out about. To start off, we are back to having our weekly discussions. Don't forget to be completing those. You'll need to do 6 by the end of the semester. If you've already done 6, fabulous for you. You have met the minimum requirement. If you do more than 6, I will take your top 6 scores for the final grade. Just keep in mind, we got to have 6 by the end of the semester that will count towards that final grade. Number 2, we are a few weeks out from those initial drafts of your final paper. That's not due until November 3rd. But now is a great time to continue working on those drafts. Take what you submitted for your annotated bibliographies, start setting that up in more of an essay style format for the final paper. And don't forget to bring in some additional resources because you may have submitted 6 for the annotated bibliography, but I expect more than that for the final paper to address your respective topics. And then, as a last note, those initial drafts are what set up our peer reviews, which will happen in the week following the submission of the initial drafts. I like to engage in peer reviews because I want you to get feedback from people in the course who are similarly situated to yourself, may know nothing about your topic, and may have good questions to ask you. So please take a look at the assignment guidelines for those upcoming assignments. Please let me know if you have any other questions or concerns. I will be working on grading the midterm exams and getting those back to you within the next week and a half. Just have a whole lot of exams to grade, so I will be doing the best I can to get those to you as soon as possible. All right, have a great rest of the week. Enjoy the cases and the reading. Again, don't go too far into the details for some of these cases. They can get a little bit heavy, but do let me know what questions or concerns you have. You can always email me at jemille@wsc.edu. Take care and have a great rest of the week.